You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. I'm excited to welcome into the studio today a very special guest. He has quite a unique background, so please be patient while I introduce him. Dr. Bryce Smedley is currently an assistant professor in the Masters of Teaching program at Southern Oregon University. Now, before returning to Ashland, Dr. Smedley was a Foreign Service officer. He served as Deputy Director of Education for USAID in the Democratic Republic of Congo and as the education team lead in Burma. Dr. Smedley has also served as an English language specialist for the U.S. State Department in Angola, Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Union of Comoros, focusing on youth empowerment through language education. Dr. Smedley has extensive experience working in a number of African countries. Additionally, he served as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya, working in the field of HIV education and agroforestry. Dr. Smedley earned a bachelor's degree in cultural anthropology from the University of Montana, and during his undergraduate education, he attended the University of Ghana and studied linguistics and international education. He received his first master's degree in international development in Bangkok, Thailand, and his second master's degree and his PhD in literacy, culture, and language education at Indiana University. When the Trump administration dismantled USAID earlier this year, Dr. Smedley returned to Ashland and assumed his current role at Southern Oregon University. Welcome to The Exchange, Dr. Smedley.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've had quite the experience. Help us understand where you were and what you were doing when you first heard the news that USAID was being dismantled.
Well, we had gotten a pretty good indication that things weren't going to be normal a couple days after President Trump was sworn in this January. And then within days, we had a stop work order where we had a gag order, no work. There's a full review of every kind of project, program we were running across the entire agency. And then it became quickly realized within that there was really no review. It was a dismantling of a university. And so comments from those who had been through many transitions were saying, oh, it's normal. This is normal to something seriously wrong. And then we started getting word. I was in Bangkok, Thailand, as the team lead for our education work in Burma, or as they call themselves, Myanmar. We were hearing that it looked like they were going to shut down the agency. Court cases were filed, but official notification that the agency would be shut down, or my RIF letter, my reduction in force, came the evening that Myanmar in the Zagayan region suffered a 7.7 magnitude earthquake. And because it was such a shallow earthquake, it was felt all the way in Bangkok, where 107 people died that day. And so after running down 12 flights of stairs in Bangkok and joining thousands of people on the streets, trying to identify where colleagues were at that very moment, happy that the building that I was just in wasn't collapsing, although it felt that way, I had actually gotten the email from the agency that my time was no longer needed. So it was kind of a gut punch, but it was at that moment that it became kind of very real that they were going to eviscerate the agency and wipe it out. And that was in March, March 27th.
Okay. So at the time that you received that news, you were dealing with a real earthquake.
Yeah. We were evacuating other American USAID and State Department employees out of the building. It was, yeah, probably one of the strongest earthquakes I'd ever sat through. And so it literally sounds like if you've had the unfortunate experience of being an earthquake that the building was collapsing on itself. It was so severe that we couldn't move back into our apartments for a couple weeks. Our mission headquarters was closed for a week or so. Due to the severity of damage to the house, to that. And so it was a gut punch. And then it was trying to reach colleagues inside of Myanmar and a lot of our implementing partners inside of Myanmar, where, you know, thousands of people had lost their lives. At that time, we also, in the program I worked in education, I had students that we had placed in countries around Southeast Asia who were doing their scholarship program. And so we also had trying to figure out, you know, where people are and if they're safe. And this is when the entire agency had gotten that we were no longer needed.
Where was your family?
Bangkok. Down the street, not in the same building I was in, but it was hard. I was in shock from the actual earthquake for a couple of days. But the day, getting that on the same day later that night, was, you know, heart-wrenching. So
while the building didn't collapse, your career did.
The career did collapse for me and for about 10,000 other people with the agency. People who had served, I had served about 8 years, others had served decades, some were a year away from their pension. And it was, they showed us the door, not just for American Foreign Service officers posted overseas, but also civil servants posted in the U.S. at the Ronald Reagan Building. And then what should be mentioned, thousands and thousands of Foreign Service nationals who are locally employed staff who have committed their life for American foreign policy. And they, too, lost their entire careers and shown the door.
So let's go back. Tell me what is or what was USAID and what purpose did it serve?
So USAID was founded on November 3rd, 1961, by John F. Kennedy. And it had was kind of a product of the Cold War, but it took on a much different kind of shape over the years. It was a way, just like Peace Corps, to show American generosity towards the country. Now, it's not perfect. It made mistakes. It was also an arm of the three pillars of American foreign policy, which is diplomacy, defense, and development. Interesting side note, when USAID was being attacked this year, some of the greatest defenders coming to USAID's defense were the military, because they understand the work we do, which is very different than diplomacy, which is political, and very different than defense. So USAID did development work and humanitarian work. Development work's the hard work. That's the work that goes beyond the humanitarian crisis. You know, the humanitarian crisis, the things we do on day one, day two, day three is critically important, but those are also photo opportunities for certain people who want to look like we're doing it. The hard work is rebuilding a country that can take years after that. How do you rebuild clinics or schools or infrastructure, the investments there? And that's the development part. It also, you know, bought food from American farmers and for, you know, Feed the Future, and provided American produce and food to prevent famine and, you know, and those sorts of things. And that's what, and it was by the American people. So the slogan is, everything we did in my entire time overseas when I was working with groups or implementing partners, it was working by the American people. And it was a way for us to give back. And for less than 1% of the budget, and one of the big kind of misunderstandings is how much money does it cost to run USAID when you look at the entire government? Well, that'd be less than 1% of the budget. So it's very cost effective. But that was the function of USAID, was to be there when no one else was there, to work with in conflict zones, to work in places, to keep things like Ebola at you know, far away from reaching our shores, to prevent easily, you know, deaths from chlorio, or provide HIV medicine to those. And so that's kind of what we did.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Bryce Smedley. He's an assistant professor in the Masters of Teaching program at Southern Oregon University, and we're talking about his work as a Foreign Service officer with USAID. You can also join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So you were there, and you had a staff. You also had a budget. Tell me about that.
Sure. So we had about, I was part of the economic growth team, and I ran the education wing of that. And then I shared that with the agriculture team, and they were working with farmers across the country. My work was with ethnic communities across the border that's been in a state of conflict with the military junta that overthrew the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi in 2021. Here we were working mostly with ethnic communities, most of them Baptist, some Christians, and then others that were providing learning opportunities for their students. And why this is important is because these communities have and continue to undergo intense airstrikes from the Burmese military. They purposely target health clinics, schools, and we wanted to make sure that these children had some sort of resources, like the ability to learn how to read or write, or they had abilities to create a safer school. So when airstrikes would come, that there were bunkers and other things that they could go to, and they could piece back their lives. And so we were working to make sure that they had something. And then other offices at the mission were trying to support to make sure that they had vaccines and at least we could help, clinics provide some sort of resources. And that was basically the function, is to really stand with these people. And more importantly, these people were suffering because they believed in this idea called democracy and elections. And that was important. That's been part of our foreign policy for a while under the Burma Act. One of the strongest advocates for the Burma policy, too, was Senator Mitch McConnell, who has been a strong supporter of the people of Myanmar. And it was passed under Republican leadership, the Burma Act. And so we were, which is an authorization to do this kinds of work. And that's what we had been doing.
So you were building relationships.
We were doing much more than just building relationships. We were making sure that children had access to learn how to read and write, that they had access to vaccines, that we could support farmers, and on top of that, create relationships that could help them be resilient so that one day they can have a much more freer, prosperous society. And that's the long work. So an interesting thing is when we would have State Department colleagues arrive at post, they would often come to USAID officers and say, who do you know? Because we have to understand, State Department works at a very high level. They do reporting back to DC. They create the relationships at the very, very high level. But they don't know all the people that make kind of the country run. And that happens at the community level. That happens at the provinces. And that's why how the USAID is very different than State Department is because we're in the field. We know the local, community leaders. We understand kind of the development challenges. And that's why they would constantly look to us to really introduce them to a country that they're not going to get kind of in a bubble sitting in an embassy that has very limited eyes, what happens outside those walls.
So what was the cost of that benefit?
The cost of that benefit of being in the community?
Yeah.
Yeah. The cost of that benefit is we truly can make an impact in people's lives. We can help them rebuild. But more importantly, we can provide critical information of what's actually happening in our country to our colleagues at State Department and to others so they understand what the realities are. Oftentimes, when you're sitting in a capital city and you're meeting with a minister and you're reporting on what they're saying, you're getting a very narrow view of what's happening in the country. What USAID does is they show evidence of how we can use money to develop and rebuild and reach actual goals to bring a country along down a development path, to make them much more resilient so that when they do have shocks to the system, communities can rebuild. What it does in education is it builds generations of people who have a strong kindness or mutual feelings for Americans as partners. And so those partnerships that are created are felt, throughout the country, not at the most elite kind of political class. And that's the purpose of USAID. The purpose here isn't to flatter Americans. It's to work with some of the most marginalized, hard-hitting communities in the field to build relationships, rebuild countries, to hopefully save lives. One thing you can say about USAID is it allowed more children under the age of five to reach the age of five than any other agency that the U.S. government has. 90 million people lives were saved by USAID's work over 60 years. It had strong bipartisan support by both Republicans and Democrats. And I remember after Trump's election last November, I was hired under his first administration. We were excited to see who he was going to nominate to be the administrator, and talking about how we need to reprioritize what we're doing to fit this administration's goals. And that's another thing that I think has been really devastating for a lot of foreign service officers with USAID is they're nonpartisan. They happily work for either a Republican or a Democrat. That's the job.
Okay, so when we come back, I want to get into that whole process of working for different administrations, and now that USAID no longer exists, why? I'll be right back with Dr. Bryce Smedley, assistant professor in the Masters of Teaching program at Southern Oregon University. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Bryce Smedley. He's an assistant professor in the Masters of Teaching program at Southern Oregon University. And before returning to Ashland this year, Dr. Smedley was a Foreign Service officer. He served as Deputy Director of Education for USAID in the Democratic Republic of Congo and as the education team lead in Burma, also known as Myanmar. You can also join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Now, before the break, we were talking about the impact of the dissolution of USAID. Dr. Smedley, you ran a division of that. What was your budget and what was the budget overall for USAID?
So in 2024, the overall budget for the entire agency was around $21 billion. For the education part that I worked on, it was probably around $25 million, and that's broken up over years. And so every year you get appropriated funds from the Congress, and that's how we spend that. For the mission, it was closer to around $100 million. But you have to understand a lot of that goes to the health, vaccines, agriculture, peace and security, the overall operating cost. How USAID works is it works either through contracts or cooperative agreements. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times we contract, groups win bids, we contract or do a cooperative agreement with those mostly faith-based organizations with a strong drive for localization as well, and then international NGOs that are usually based out of the U.S. One of the, sad facts about 2025 is the hits that this hit on faith-based charitable organizations and nonprofits throughout the United States. And so all of them had huge layoffs or terminations because they lost also those opportunities to continue those programs. Every penny we had to use, though, we had to account for. And I mean down to the penny. And so we were considered for a federal agency to be probably the top of its ability to actually report on how we use money. Actually, under Trump's administration, the OIG report that was released, I believe, in June, the OIG Inspector General had said that USAID's financial, where there were issues or concerns was 0.0017. That's how good we were with it. Now, when you work in non-permissive environments around the world, you must keep your eye on how money is spent because those places are built around corruption. And so you're working in basically kleptocracies. And so any kind of funding you put there, you really do need to put it in checks and balances, which, might be one of the reasons why USAID was targeted in the first place.
So that gets me to my next question, because it was one of the very first or major organizations that just was completely demolished by this administration, seemingly overnight. It begs the question of why, because one of the things you said is that, one, you're dealing with faith-based organizations, but the vast majority of Trump's base are white Christian evangelicals. So they are faith-based. Also, you're telling me that the efficiency factor for USAID was pretty much off the charts. Now, the closure of USAID received widespread condemnation, including former presidents Barack Obama and George Bush. And the BBC has reported that the U.S. State Department pushed back on that and proclaimed that it could continue to administer aid, but in a more efficient way.
Yeah.
And I find that remarkable. From your perspective, what led the Trump administration to dismantling USAID?
All right. Well, that's a really big question. One question every single person should ask themselves is, in the 2024 election, how many times was the word USAID brought up as an issue in debates? It was never mentioned. Yes, we had heard about Project 2025, but you ask a really important question. Why did the Department of Government Efficiency under Elon Musk go straight for USAID? And that's a big question. I mean, it is known that Musk gave, what, $280 million to Trump's campaign. Trump gave him the axe, and he went straight for USAID, for an agency that was known for its efficiency and its quiet work overseas to build friends and relationships.
Well, that's ironic. The Department of Government Efficiency axed the most efficient government agency.
Right, where they basically hired, you know, 20-year-olds to storm agencies and start firing. It's brutal. There's so many stories there about how when you turn something off, you can't really turn it on. Well, he came for USAID, so it should be known that somehow what has been reported in the news and elsewhere, he became concerned, Musk came concerned with USAID when they started investigating Starlink satellites over Ukraine, and OIG started an investigation into his work because they were realizing that those satellites were being accessed by Russians and using that against Ukraine. And then there were concerns over Myanmar. And that was enough for someone like Elon Musk, who is, I hate to say, the richest person in the world, maybe you could say the greediest, to go after an agency that supports and helps the poorest people in the world. I would assume that when you're a transnational oligarch, I mean, he's a foreign-born oligarch, you know, that you want to eliminate any agency that's working on journalism, anti-corruption, and ensuring that people around the world have a right to fair and free elections. That must hurt your profit margin. But it was not by quit, you know, it was a methodical, the attack on USAID in a brutal, chaotic way. But he knew what he needed to eliminate, and he went straight for an agency that would put his kind of work overseas in check. And that's exactly what happened. By doing that, though, what you had seen is a Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who had praised USAID when he sat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for years, all of a sudden shift his tone and start saying it had lost its purpose. But then again, you're talking about a lifelong politician who probably has aspirations to be the president, and you're talking about a person who has access to hundreds of millions of dollars, billions, he has billions of dollars, who's going to be needed to fund those campaigns. Which is a problem with our society when you have people who can dump $25 million into a Supreme Court race in, you know, in Wisconsin, that's nothing, $25 million for them, who can dump $280 million into a presidential campaign, who can basically dictate now foreign policy based on their own interest. So there, you know, it wasn't by coincidence that he came after USAID, but what you had to do is inform a public who might have known very little about USAID. And when you own the public square like Twitter, you can drop statements whether they're true or not true. And we are at such a point in the United States that the ability to just dialogue and listen and learn, regardless of your political affiliation, has kind of been wiped out by social media, dropping a grenade in a conversation, and then half the people are gonna say, well, that has to be true because I read it. And right. I think that's really a hard thing. And the truth is, you had mentioned it earlier in your question, the devastation that fell on civil servants and foreign service officers and others who lost their careers, some two people, one, many of them haven't found work. Many of them, you know, are, you know, have lost the ability to pay for children's tuition, pay their mortgages. Unfortunately, we've lost a few people due to unable to cope. I mean, it has been devastating across the country, and not just with USAID, but for federal employees across the country. You know, we swore an oath to the Constitution to work on behalf of the American people, and to be discredited and attacked because you want to have a political win is not the right way you should do it. If you want to eliminate an agency like USAID, do it the proper way. Go through Congress, and you probably could have gotten it that way. Systematically close down an agency. You do not have to attack, defame, lie, and damage a reputation and hurt the American people by discrediting our work for 60 years to get whatever you want. You can do it in a much more respectable, honest way, and you may still be able to achieve your goals. We didn't see that in 2025.
My studio guest is Dr. Bryce Smedley. He's an assistant professor in the Masters of Teaching program at Southern Oregon University. We're talking about his work as a foreign service officer with USAID. Now, speaking of shifts, you talked about Marco Rubio shifting his position. USAID was seen as integral to the global aid system. But after Trump's cuts were announced, other countries also reduced support, including the UK, France, and Germany. Why?
It's a really good point. You know, I still think that much of the world looks to us for leadership. And I think what you're seeing in the United States, you see also other countries do the same. The truth is, you know, we owe it to, we are part of one planet, one people. We shouldn't live on a planet where people don't have enough food to eat, where people are suffering from conflict, where people don't have the chance to live a healthy life. And we have to make decisions along those ways. You do see cuts now across the world. Part of that, though, is because we're becoming a much more dangerous planet. And countries in Europe are starting to put money where they think they have to, which is in defense. You have Russia and Ukraine. You have China as a global power. And you see the great surrender of American leadership across the world. And quite honestly, from everything that you read in the paper, most countries who could count on American partnership or leadership no longer feel that way because we're vanishing. You know, we have abandoned essentially Africa, and which blows my mind because China and Russia understand how critically important it is. I mean, how many times has, you know, the leader of China been to Africa in the last 10 years? Dozens. How many times has the current president of the United States been to Africa ever? Zero. What is the most famous thing he said about people and countries in Africa? Yeah, I won't say it on the radio, but you know what it is.
Yes.
And I remember once standing years ago before I had joined USAID when I was at Southern Oregon University working with youth in Bangui, Central African Republic, and a young girl, this was in an Islamic part of the city in Bangui, rose her hand. There's about 100 children, and she asked that question. She goes, "Why did your president say this about Africa?" And I'm standing on this stage, and now I have to, as an American, not part of the government, answer that in a diplomatic way that doesn't reinforce his image. If you look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, they're sitting on $57 trillion of natural resources.
A lot of resources throughout the entire continent.
And if a lot. And if you look at just one province in the DRC, near Lubumbashi, Katanga province, 80% of all those mines now are owned by Chinese companies. You can walk downtown Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and you can meet young Congolese men who can speak Mandarin, and they have never been to China. We have our foreign policy, and it's not a Republican-Democrat thing, it's not a Trump thing either, for the last 20 years is chaotic. It doesn't make sense in so many ways. And we're not embracing, you know, these countries as true partners. We are now at a point where everything's transactional, and that is not what development should be, nor humanitarian work. But we just don't have the right people making good decisions around foreign policy, and we have basically given up on any kind of leadership. And the dismantling of USAID reinforces that we cannot be counted on. When you close down HIV clinics, 600,000 people now have estimated to die since the dismantling of USAID. A lot of these communities will never forgive us for not turning away in a systematic way, running away and surrendering. And what have we surrendered? We have surrendered the field to China and Russia.
Okay, well, I could talk to you all day about this. I mean, I didn't get through half of my questions, but we only have about 30 seconds left, unfortunately. You moved back here. When USAID was dismantled, where did everyone go?
I am very proud of, I love the Rogue Valley. I love Southern Oregon and Southern Oregon University and with the School of Education. They offered me a short time, you know, position to kind of as a soft landing. I love teachers and preparing teachers. I've worked in a classroom for many years. Most Americans that I worked with, a lot of them have not returned, and they may never. I feel that as an educator, we have to rebuild and create ways to work across the political spectrum, conservatives, liberals. I come from a conservative family. I've been part of both parties. Now I'm an independent. We have to rebuild this country, and we have to talk about why foreign aid is important. And that happens here in the United States. So I chose to come here to a place that I love.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Dr. Smedley. My guest was Dr. Bryce Smedley, assistant professor in the Master of Teaching program at SOU.